A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's reflecting on an earlier conversation we had about social engineering, where we talked through some creative ruses for convincing building managers you're part of a professional moving operation. He points out that most people encounter the term social engineering strictly in the cybersecurity context, but the actual discipline predates technology by centuries. Intelligence agencies, con artists, petty criminals, they've all been practicing versions of this without calling it by name. He wants us to trace the actual lineage and history of social engineering as a formal discipline, and especially to map out the framework of exploits beyond just the digital context, which, honestly, is long overdue.
It really is. And the thing that jumped out at me immediately is that most people think social engineering was invented by Kevin Mitnick in the 90s. Which is like saying gravity was invented by Isaac Newton. He named it and systematized it, but the phenomenon itself is ancient.
The apple was always falling, is what you're saying.
The apple was always falling, and people were always exploiting trust, authority, fear, urgency, the whole toolkit, long before anyone wrote a textbook about it. The term social engineering itself has a political origin that most cybersecurity people don't know. Yeah, it was coined in the late 19th century by a Dutch industrialist named Jay. He used the phrase sociale ingenieurs to describe the idea that industrialists should apply scientific management principles to human relations, essentially engineering society for efficiency. It had nothing to do with deception. It was more like, how do we design workplace harmony?
The original social engineers were middle managers with clipboards.
The phrase then got picked up by political philosophers in the early 20th century. Karl Popper used it critically in The Open Society and Its Enemies to describe utopian planners who try to reshape society through top-down design. Which, you know, he wasn't a fan.
I can see why. Let me redesign your society for you is not a great opening line.
And then the term migrated into its modern security, meaning sometime in the 1980s and 90s, largely through the phone-freaking community. But here's the thing. The actual practice of manipulating people to gain access or information is arguably as old as human civilization.
Walk me through what that lineage actually looks like. Because I think when people hear social engineering, they picture a guy in a hoodie calling a help desk and pretending to be from IT. But you're saying the framework is much deeper.
Let's start with the ancients. There's a great example from Herodotus. He writes about a Greek named Silasen who wanted to gain favor with Darius the Great of Persia. Silasen had once given Darius a red cloak years earlier when Darius was just a nobody guardsman. When Darius became king, Silasen showed up at the palace gates and told the guards he was an old benefactor of the king. He used a genuine prior relationship, a thin one, but real, and leveraged it into access. That is pretexting, right? Building a credible identity around a kernel of truth.
The guards let him in.
They let him in, and Darius remembered the cloak, and Silasen ended up being granted the island of Samos. All because he knew how to frame a relationship to his advantage.
The Red Cloak of Samos sounds like a mediocre fantasy novel.
The pattern is recognizable. Or take the Trojan Horse, which is arguably the most famous social engineering exploit in history. The Greeks didn't breach Troy's walls through force. They breached them by understanding Trojan psychology. They created a narrative that appealed to Trojan pride and religious sentiment. They built a physical prop to sell the story, and they left behind a single operative, Sinon, whose entire job was to be a convincing liar.
Sinon is the original inside man.
He's the original inside man. He presented himself as a deserter, a victim of Greek cruelty, which made him sympathetic. He played on the Trojan sense of honor. He gave them a plausible story for why the horse was there. It was an offering to Athena, and if the Trojans destroyed it, they'd incur divine wrath. But if they brought it inside their walls, they'd gain Athena's favor. Every element of that story was tailored to the audience.
You've got pretexting, you've got a physical prop, you've got an emotional appeal to pride and fear, and you've got a plausible cover story. That's basically the entire modern framework in one operation.
It really is. And then fast forward to the Renaissance, you've got figures like Count Alessandro di Cagliostro, who was an 18th century con artist and forger of breathtaking skill. He traveled across Europe convincing nobility and royalty that he was a great alchemist and mystic. He sold fake elixirs, he claimed to be centuries old, he infiltrated the court of Louis XVI. His whole method was what we now call authority exploitation. He dressed the part, he spoke with conviction, he dropped names, he created an aura of mystery that made people want to believe him.
Authority exploitation is interesting because it's not just about claiming to be an authority figure. It's about triggering the target's deference reflex.
And the deference reflex is deeply wired. There's a famous study by Stanley Milgram, not the obedience experiment, but the one where researchers stood on a sidewalk and stared up at nothing. When one person did it, passersby ignored them. When a group of five did it, strangers started stopping and staring up too. The social proof heuristic is incredibly powerful, and con artists have been exploiting it for centuries.
The crowd of people staring at the sky thing is basically the analog version of a phishing email that says, 9 of your colleagues have already responded.
And the history of espionage is basically a laboratory for social engineering techniques. Take the Cambridge Five, the Soviet spy ring that operated inside British intelligence during and after World War II. Kim Philby, Guy Burgess, Donald MacLean, and the others. They didn't hack into systems. They didn't steal codebooks by force. They cultivated relationships. They exploited institutional trust. They presented themselves as the right sort of people. Proper education, proper accents, proper clubs. The entire British class system was their attack surface.
They engineered their social position to become the system.
And that's the thing about social engineering that the digital framing misses. It's not always about a single interaction, a single phone call, a single phishing email. Sometimes it's about long-term cultivation of a persona. The confidence game, the con and con artist, is short for confidence. You build the mark's confidence in you over time.
The con is not the crime. The con is the relationship.
The con is the relationship, and the crime is the withdrawal at the end.
Which brings us to the intelligence community. Because they've obviously been doing this at scale for decades.
The CIA's Office of Technical Service had a dedicated group for what they called operational behavioral science. During the Cold War, they studied things like how to read microexpressions, how to establish rapid rapport, how to exploit cultural norms in different societies. There's a declassified manual from the 1940s, the Simple Sabotage Field Manual. That's basically a social engineering playbook disguised as a guide for resistance operatives.
What kind of things did it recommend?
The famous part is the workplace sabotage recommendations. Things like hold meetings when there is more critical work to be done, insist on doing everything through channels, refer all matters to committees. The idea was to slow down enemy organizations through bureaucratic friction. But the manual also covered things like how to cultivate a false identity, how to recruit assets by identifying psychological vulnerabilities, how to create division within organizations.
The CIA was teaching people to be the most annoying middle manager possible, as a weapon.
As a weapon. And the techniques for asset recruitment are particularly relevant here. Intelligence agencies developed a framework called MICE, money, ideology, coercion, ego, for understanding what motivates someone to betray their organization. The social engineer is essentially doing the same thing in a compressed time frame. They're identifying which of those levers will work on a target and pulling it.
If someone at a building's front desk is motivated by a desire to feel important, you stroke their ego. If they're motivated by fear of getting in trouble, you present yourself as an authority figure who can get them in trouble.
And the intelligence community has refined this into a systematic discipline. The Russians, for instance, were masters of what they called kompromat, compromising material. But kompromat wasn't always gathered through surveillance or hacking. Often it was gathered through social engineering, setting up situations where a target could be compromised, then using that as leverage. The classic honey trap is social engineering.
The honey trap is fascinating because it's not about technology at all. It's about understanding human desire and using it as an access vector.
And the digital version of the honey trap, the romance scam, the catfishing operation, is just the same technique with a different delivery mechanism. The underlying psychology is identical.
Let's map this out. If someone wanted to create a framework of social engineering exploits that's broader than the digital context, what would that look like?
I think you can break it down into a few core principles. The first is what I'd call the trust exploitation vectors. These are the psychological levers you can pull. Authority. Exploiting the human tendency to defer to perceived authority figures. Urgency. Creating artificial time pressure that short-circuits rational evaluation. Social proof. Leveraging the tendency to follow what others are doing. Scarcity. Making something seem rare or exclusive to increase its desirability. Liking. Building rapport so the target wants to help you. Fear. Making the target afraid of a negative outcome if they don't comply.
That's basically Robert Cialdini's influence framework.
It is, and Cialdini's work is foundational to modern social engineering. But these principles predate Cialdini by millennia. They're not techniques that someone invented. They're vulnerabilities in human cognition that someone discovered and exploited.
Which is an important distinction. A vulnerability is not a technique. A vulnerability is a property of the system.
The human cognitive architecture has certain properties. Deference to authority, susceptibility to social proof, tendency to trust people who seem similar to us, and those properties are the attack surface. The techniques are just ways of triggering those vulnerabilities.
What are the techniques then? If the vulnerabilities are the what? What's the how?
I think you can group them into a few categories. Pretexting, creating a false identity or scenario. This is the core technique. Baiting, offering something desirable to get the target to take an action. Tailgating, physically following an authorized person into a restricted area. Quid pro quo, offering a service or benefit in exchange for information or access. Phishing and its variants, sending deceptive communications designed to elicit a response. Shoulder surfing, observing the target to gather information. Dumpster diving, gathering discarded information.
Most of those don't require a computer.
Most of them don't. Tailgating is purely physical. Shoulder surfing is purely physical. Dumpster diving is purely physical. Baiting can be physical. Leave a USB drive in a parking lot and someone will pick it up and plug it in. But it can also be entirely non-digital. Leave an envelope marked confidential salary information in a break room and watch who opens it.
The USB drive in the parking lot is a classic pen test move, but you're saying the same principle works with a physical object and human curiosity.
Curiosity is one of the most reliable exploits in the entire toolkit. There's a reason Pandora's Box is one of the oldest stories we have. Humans cannot resist the unknown.
Let's talk about the formal study of this. You mentioned that the term migrated into security in the 80s and 90s. When did it become an actual discipline that people studied systematically?
The watershed moment was really Kevin Mitnick's book, The Art of Deception, in 2002. Mitnick was a phone freaker and hacker who served time in prison and then became a security consultant. His book was the first to really systematize social engineering attacks in a way that organizations could use for defense. But even before Mitnick, there were people doing this work. Frank Abagnale, the con artist portrayed in Catch Me If You Can, eventually became a security consultant for the FBI. He taught agents how to spot forgery and fraud. His expertise wasn't technical, it was entirely about human deception. And in the intelligence community, there were behavioral scientists developing frameworks for counterintelligence that were essentially social engineering defense playbooks.
The discipline emerges from a weird convergence of reformed criminals and intelligence professionals.
Which is how a lot of security disciplines emerge, honestly. The people who best understand how to break a system are the people who've broken it.
What does the current framework look like if you were going to teach someone social engineering as a formal discipline?
The most widely used framework is probably the social engineering kill chain. It's modeled on the cyber kill chain from Lockheed Martin. The stages are reconnaissance, where you gather information about the target. Weaponization, where you craft your pretext. Delivery, where you make contact. Exploitation, where you trigger the vulnerability. Installation, where you establish persistence, maintaining the relationship or access. Command and control, where you direct the target to take actions. And actions on objectives, where you achieve your goal.
It's a structured process. It's not just be charming and hope for the best.
It's incredibly structured. And the reconnaissance phase is often the most important and the most overlooked. Professional social engineers will spend days or weeks gathering information before they ever make contact. They'll study organizational charts, they'll read social media, they'll learn the internal jargon, they'll identify the key decision makers and gatekeepers.
The internal jargon thing is interesting. If you show up and use the right terminology, people assume you belong.
That's called code switching in the social engineering context. Every organization has its own internal language, acronyms, project names, shorthand for processes. If you can deploy that language naturally, you've already passed the first authenticity check. It's the verbal equivalent of wearing the right uniform.
Which brings us back to the moving operations scenario. Knowing what a professional mover would actually say, what paperwork they'd have, what questions they'd ask.
The more specific your pretext, the more credible it is. Generic pretexts fail because they don't match the target's mental model of reality. But a detailed pretext, one that anticipates questions, that includes verifiable details, that accounts for inconsistencies, is incredibly hard to detect.
Let's talk about the ethical dimension. Because Daniel mentioned that ethical use cases are narrow, and he's right. But there's a whole field of professional penetration testing that uses these techniques.
It's growing. Red teams now routinely include social engineering in their engagements. The idea is that you can have the best firewalls in the world, but if an attacker can convince your receptionist to let them in, none of that matters. There's a famous quote from Mitnick. You can have the best technology, firewalls, intrusion detection systems, and biometric devices. All it takes is a single phone call to an unsuspecting employee.
The receptionist isn't the failure point. The system that put the receptionist in a position to make that decision without adequate training, that's the failure point.
That's the crucial reframe. Security awareness training is basically teaching people to recognize the social engineering kill chain as it's happening. To spot the authority exploitation, the urgency pressure, the pretext inconsistencies. It's not about turning employees into paranoid cynics. It's about giving them a mental framework for evaluating unusual requests.
Which is why understanding the framework matters, even if you're never going to use it offensively. If you don't know what the exploits look like, you can't defend against them.
The exploits are constantly evolving. One of the things that's emerged in the last few years is what's called vishing as a service, organized criminal groups that offer voice phishing operations for hire. They have call centers, they have scripts, they have quality assurance processes. It's industrialized social engineering.
Quality assurance for scam calls. That's horrifying.
It's a business. They track conversion rates, they A-B test scripts, they optimize for different demographics. The same techniques that legitimate businesses use to improve customer engagement are being used to improve victim engagement.
The framework isn't just about individual techniques. It's about understanding the entire operational model.
And the operational model has a few key components that span across digital and physical domains. First, target selection. How do you choose who to attack? Second, information gathering. What can you learn about the target before making contact? Third, pretext development. What identity or scenario will you present? Fourth, contact execution. How do you make the approach? Fifth, exploitation. How do you achieve the objective? Sixth, exfiltration and cleanup. How do you get out without leaving traces?
The cleanup phase is interesting because in the physical world, it's very different from the digital world. You can't just delete logs.
In the physical world, cleanup is about managing the target's memory of the interaction. You want them to remember you as unremarkable, forgettable, not worth mentioning. Professional social engineers talk about the importance of being the gray man, someone who blends in so completely that witnesses can't provide a useful description.
The gray man. That's a term from surveillance tradecraft, isn't it?
And it connects to a broader point about the relationship between social engineering and intelligence operations. The intelligence community has been developing and refining these techniques for decades, but they've done it under different names: operational security, cover development, elicitation, asset recruitment. The underlying principles are the same, but the terminology is different.
If you're trying to understand the full scope of social engineering, you almost have to read across multiple disciplines: cybersecurity, intelligence studies, psychology, even stage magic.
Stage magic is a great example. Magicians are essentially social engineers. They manipulate attention, they exploit cognitive biases, they use misdirection to control what the audience perceives. A lot of the techniques that pickpockets use, creating physical misdirection, exploiting the brain's limited attentional bandwidth, are directly applicable to social engineering.
The pickpocket is the ultimate physical social engineer.
there's a whole taxonomy of pickpocket techniques that maps onto social engineering. The bump, creating a physical distraction while an accomplice does the actual theft. The stall, using a confederate to block the target's path while the pickpocket works. The sandwich, surrounding the target in a crowd to limit their movement. All of these are about controlling the target's environment and attention.
The framework scales from convince a receptionist to let you in, all the way up to run a multi-year intelligence operation against a foreign government.
The principles are the same. The stakes are different, the complexity is different, but the underlying psychology is identical. And that's what makes it a genuine discipline rather than just a bag of tricks. There are foundational principles that apply regardless of context.
What would you say those foundational principles are, if you had to distill it down to the absolute core?
I'd say there are three. First, all social engineering exploits a gap between perception and reality. The target perceives a situation one way, and the reality is different. Second, all social engineering leverages pre-existing trust structures, authority relationships, social norms, institutional routines. You're not creating trust from nothing, you're hijacking trust that already exists. Third, all social engineering works because the human brain is a pattern-matching machine that takes shortcuts. Those shortcuts are usually right, which is why they exist, but they can be exploited.
That third point is important. The cognitive biases that make social engineering possible aren't bugs. They're features that work correctly 99% of the time.
You want your brain to defer to authority in most situations. If a police officer tells you to stop, you should stop. If a doctor tells you to take a medication, you should take it. The problem is that the authority signal can be faked.
The defense isn't to stop trusting authority. It's to verify that the authority is genuine.
Verification is the core defensive principle, and verification has to be out of band. If someone calls you claiming to be from your bank, you don't verify by asking them for information. You hang up and call the number on your card. If someone shows up claiming to be from IT, you don't verify by looking at their badge. You call the IT department directly. The verification channel has to be independent of the contact channel.
That's a simple rule that would prevent most social engineering attacks, and yet almost nobody does it.
Because it's friction. It's easier to just trust the person in front of you. And social engineers know that. They count on the fact that most people will take the path of least resistance.
Let's talk about the history a bit more. You mentioned the Cold War era. What about before that? Were there formalized approaches to deception in, say, the medieval period?
The medieval period had an entire profession dedicated to what we now call social engineering, heralds. Heralds were responsible for diplomatic communication between courts, and part of their job was to present themselves in a way that commanded respect and authority. They wore distinctive tabards, they carried staffs of office, they used formal language. The entire heraldic system was a framework for establishing credible authority in an era before photographs, before ID cards, before any of the verification tools we take for granted.
The tabard was the medieval version of a fake badge.
It worked because the system was built on recognition of symbols rather than recognition of individuals. If you showed up wearing the right tabard and speaking the right language, you were a herald. Nobody could Google you.
Which makes me think about the East India Company and colonial era trade. That must have been a golden age for imposters.
There's a fascinating figure named George Psalmanazar who showed up in London in the early 1700s claiming to be a native of Formosa, modern-day Taiwan. He had an elaborate fake language, a fake alphabet, fake religious practices. He wrote an entire book about Formosan culture that was completely fabricated. He convinced bishops, scientists, and society figures. He was eventually exposed, but he maintained the ruse for years.
What was his exploit vector?
Exoticism and the hunger for novelty. Europeans were fascinated by accounts of distant lands, and there was no way to verify anything he said, so he built an entire world out of nothing and sold it to an eager audience. It's a textbook example of what we'd now call a long con pretext.
The more elaborate the fiction, the harder it is to challenge. Because challenging any one part of it means you have to challenge the entire edifice.
That's called the too big to fail principle in fraud examination. The more complex and detailed the deception is, the less likely people are to question it. The human brain assumes that complexity implies authenticity, when in fact complexity is often a sign of fabrication. Reality is actually quite simple most of the time.
Reality is boring. Fictions are interesting.
Social engineers exploit that. They make their pretext interesting enough to capture attention, but not so interesting that they trigger skepticism. It's a calibration problem.
Where does the discipline go from here? What's the frontier?
I think there are two frontiers. One is AI-generated social engineering. We're already seeing deepfake audio being used in phishing attacks, a CEO's voice cloned from earnings calls used to instruct an employee to transfer money. That's only going to get more sophisticated.
The deepfake CEO call is terrifying because it combines authority exploitation with technological verisimilitude. You're not just claiming to be the CEO. You sound exactly like the CEO.
The emotional response to hearing a familiar voice overrides the rational verification process. It's the same vulnerability. Deference to authority. But the trigger is much more powerful.
What's the other frontier?
The other frontier is what I'd call social engineering at scale through information operations. Disinformation campaigns, influence operations, the kind of thing we've seen state actors doing on social media. These are social engineering attacks where the target is not an individual or an organization, but an entire population. The techniques are the same. Pretexting, authority exploitation, emotional manipulation, but they're deployed through algorithmic amplification rather than one-on-one contact.
The same principles, but the delivery mechanism is a social media platform instead of a phone call.
And the defensive frameworks for that are still in their infancy. We have reasonably good frameworks for defending against individual social engineering attacks, security awareness training, verification protocols, technical controls. But defending against population-level social engineering is a much harder problem.
Because you can't train an entire population to verify every piece of information they encounter.
You can't. And even if you could, the verification infrastructure doesn't really exist for most of the information people consume. There's no equivalent of hang up and call the number on your card for a news story or a viral video.
We're back to the fundamental problem. The human cognitive architecture has vulnerabilities that can be exploited, and we haven't figured out how to patch them at scale.
We probably never will, because the vulnerabilities are the same thing that makes human cooperation possible. Trust, deference, social proof. These are the foundations of civilization. You can't eliminate them without eliminating what makes us human.
The defense isn't elimination, it's inoculation.
Inoculation is exactly the right word. The idea is to expose people to weakened versions of the attack so they build resistance. That's what good security awareness training does. It shows people examples of social engineering attempts so they can recognize the patterns. And it works to a point. But the attackers adapt faster than the defenders can train.
That's the asymmetry problem that runs through all of security. The attacker only has to succeed once. The defender has to succeed every time.
Which is why understanding the framework matters so much. If you only know about specific attacks, you're always playing catch-up. But if you understand the underlying principles, the trust exploitation vectors, the cognitive biases, the kill chain, you can recognize novel attacks even if you've never seen that specific technique before.
That's really what Daniel was getting at, I think. The digital framing of social engineering has made people think it's a narrow technical discipline, when it's actually a broad human discipline. The computer is just the latest delivery mechanism.
The computer is the latest delivery mechanism. Before that, it was the telephone. Before that, it was the postal service. Before that, it was the printing press. Before that, it was the Herald's tabard. The delivery mechanism changes. The human vulnerabilities don't.
If someone wanted to actually study this as a formal discipline, not just read a blog post about phishing, where would they start?
I'd start with Cialdini's Influence for the Psychological Foundations, then Mitnick's The Art of Deception for the Security-Specific Framework, then Social Engineering, The Science of Human Hacking by Christopher Hadnagy, which is probably the best current textbook on the subject, and then, for the historical dimension, The Confidence Game by Maria Konnikova, which looks at con artists through a psychological lens.
That's a solid reading list.
If you want to go really deep, there's a whole literature in intelligence studies on elicitation techniques, cover development, and operational security. The CIA's declassified manuals are fascinating. The Simple Sabotage Field Manual I mentioned is publicly available and reads like a dark comedy in places.
Hold meetings when there is more critical work to be done is genuinely funny advice.
It's funny because it's true. And it's also a social engineering principle, create friction in the target's decision-making process, and they'll make worse decisions. It's the same reason why urgency is such an effective exploit. When people are rushed, they fall back on heuristics rather than analysis.
The entire discipline, when you step back, is really about understanding human decision-making and finding the edge cases where it breaks.
That's it exactly. And that's why it's such a fascinating subject. It sits at the intersection of psychology, security, sociology, and history. It's not just a bag of tricks. It's a window into how human cooperation works and how it can be subverted.
The fact that it predates computers by millennia tells you something important. The vulnerabilities aren't new. They're not going away. And the people who understand them best are the ones who study them historically, not just technically.
The historical perspective is what's missing from most discussions of social engineering. People think it started with phishing emails, when in reality, phishing emails are just the latest expression of something that's been going on since one caveman convinced another caveman that he was actually from a friendly tribe.
The original phishing email was a guy in a bearskin saying, "I come in peace."
It worked because the target wanted to believe it.
That's the uncomfortable truth at the bottom of all of this. Social engineering works because the target wants it to be true. The mark wants the handsome stranger to actually be a prince. The employee wants the urgent request from the CEO to be legitimate, so they can solve the problem and be the hero. The building manager wants the movers to be real, so the situation resolves smoothly.
The desire for the world to make sense, for people to be who they say they are, for situations to resolve cleanly, that desire is the ultimate vulnerability, and it's not a vulnerability we can patch.
Which is why the discipline will always be relevant. As long as humans are human, someone will be figuring out how to exploit that humanity.
Someone else will be figuring out how to defend it. That's the arms race.
I think we've made a pretty good case that social engineering is a lot older and a lot broader than most people think. The lineage goes from ancient Greece through the Renaissance con artists through Cold War intelligence agencies through modern red teams. The principles are consistent. The delivery mechanisms change.
The defensive frameworks are out there for anyone who wants to learn them. It starts with understanding the exploits.
A good place to end, I think. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
A Kushite royal inscription from the 4th century BCE, discovered at Meru in modern Sudan, records that King Nastasin was formally confirmed by the god Amun after a succession dispute in which no fewer than 8 priests were required to ritually revalidate the royal lineage, and the inscription specifies that 2 of them later recanted.
Well, right.
2 of them recanted. That's a personnel problem. This has been My Weird Prompts with me, Korn, and my brother Herman Poppleberry, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back with a new prompt soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.